Hi, welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we explore and try to explain some of the neglected but fundamental specifics about this field to build a more robust case for conservation. Today, we'll be discussing the way in which conservation is implemented in developing countries and how much progress has been made since conservation was historically more or less imposed on the developing world. I'm joined from Cape Town by Mao Amis. Mao had humble beginnings in rural South Sudan and Uganda. He's now founding director of AfriCGE, an organization that conducts environmental and development work across East and Southern Africa. He speaks five languages, including English and Arabic, and he's earned his PhD in natural resources management and planning. Mao speaks modestly, but from a position of rich experience in the topic that we address, as you'll hear in the conversation. For those listening, Mao and I studied together 15 years ago now, and this is the first time we've really had a proper conversation since then, except for the one in preparation for the podcast. So really good to be talking to you again, Mao. I'd like to start off the conversation asking, and this is not just for our listeners, also for me, because we've been out of touch for so long, but can you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in conservation in the first place, but also what was your career trajectory up to where you are now? And perhaps you can focus a bit on the work that you're doing now as well.
I mean, if I talk about my career trajectory, I always go back to my childhood. For me, that was almost the defining element of how I got into doing conservation work. Growing up in a rural community, running around bare feet, and just, being a child in the wilderness, scavenging for, wild fruits around, and really getting very much grounded with nature, even though it was a situation where it appeared as if, living out of poverty and so on, but that connection with nature has always been there. So when I went through to school, it almost became, obviously, growing up, everyone wanted you to be either a medical doctor or an engineer because it's seen as a way of getting out of poverty. But once I got into university, I did my bachelor's degree in education science. It became for me, it became quite obvious why nature is quite important, because the university, for example, where I was completely a typical university, all sorts of built infrastructure. There were hardly any green spaces, and so on. And I just always felt that connection of wanting to be closer to nature, because even though the university was in an urban center, after the holidays I went back into my almost semi-rural, home where we connected with nature. And then really developed the interest of wanting to do something related to nature. And in my university, then I founded what's called the Botany Society. And what we did with my colleagues at undergraduate at the time was, we mobilized the university, planted trees across the university, organized field trips to wild, to nature reserves, to university students who many of them, even though they come from this community, but have never really been to a national park, for example, because these are really tourist-driven institutions. So, I mean, to just say, respond to the questions, that I think that for me, it's my childhood upbringing that really defined my career choice, and that really is for me the guiding issue here.
So you grew up in Uganda, right?
Yes, I did. I've got a very complex history, but I always make a joke about it that I went to primary school in South Sudan because part of my heritage is South Sudanese. I went to high school in Uganda. I did my undergraduate in Kenya, and then I did my postgraduate studies in South Africa. So I always say, I'm a true African, a transect from semi-arid Sudan to, semi-temperate climate of South Africa.
And at university, did you actually found that botany society, or was it just a society that you joined?
Yes, I did. I did found it actually. So when I was at university, I was doing my degree was in education science, and it was a very small class, a group, and we were on the campus that was for a science campus. There were all sorts of societies there. There was actually a wildlife society. There was a tourism society. All of them with different orientations, but we founded the Botany Society, and our primary goal was to green the university. If I go back to exactly Moi University, the trees that we planted are all grown up. It's really very satisfying. So yeah, I founded the Botany Society, and that for me almost was the tipping point to my career in conservation, because when I founded the society, I used that to apply for a scholarship with the Tropical Biology Association, which is an outfit based out of Cambridge University in the UK. And what they did at the time was they organized field courses for emerging leaders. And what they did was they basically matched upcoming African conservation leaders with students, postgraduate students, rather students from the rest of the world, from Europe, from the States, and so on. And what they did was that they would pay the scholarships for the African students because we couldn't afford to go on to these field training courses, and the students from the rest of the world would pay their way onto the course. And that then gave me the opportunity. So I told the story of the society that we've done, and so, and because of that, I managed to get this a scholarship to go and do the field training. I remember it was in Tanzania, East Usambara Mountains. The unique thing about that training was that it was a 1 month training, but it brought some of the best scientists across the globe for 1 month to teach emerging botanists how to design field studies, for example. And I still remember one of the most respected professor who taught me at the time was, I think it's emeritus now, Francis Hale. Francis Hale pioneered studies around forest canopies, and he would, and I think he even developed, he invented a floating balloon called, I think, the dirigible, if I'm not mistaken. But he would go into Brazil and camp on top of these forest canopies for a month at a go. It was like mind-blowing expeditions. I spent 1 month with him in the forest, and for me that was, the turning point. He's written all sorts of books, and he's an amazing artist who can draw like the forest architecture. And I learned so much out of him, And so that was one opportunity that really opened my eye in terms of, first of all, the importance of protecting nature, why it's important, and that you can actually build a very fulfilling career out of conservation. So after that field training program, that was when I just finished my undergraduate degree in botany and chemistry. I was basically headed towards a teaching career. But after that training course, I think I impressed them quite well. Then they gave me ultimately the scholarship to come to South Africa to study a master's degree in conservation biology. And that's where you and I met.
Right. And then after that, you went on to work in South Africa.
Yeah, so I always make a joke that when I came to South Africa, I came in on a 14-month trip. The idea was to finish my degree and go back. But one thing led to another. So once I did my master's degree, I've always been a curious person, but at the same time, I was always spontaneous. But I remember having this strong urge after my master's degree that I wanted to do a PhD. And so I decided to stay in South Africa so I could pursue a PhD. So when I came to the University of Cape Town to study for my master's, I was very much interested in water-related issues, but also around the planning and management aspect of water. So then I did my PhD degree in conservation planning for, freshwater conservation planning. Really, the idea is around identifying where the priority areas are for freshwater conservation and what are the kind of management practices one needs to put into place to ensure that the freshwater systems are protected. So I did that, and before I finished my PhD, WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, approached me that the work that I was doing was quite interesting because my PhD fed directly into the South African part of South African legislation that was developing towards protecting freshwater ecosystems, identifying the national freshwater priority areas for South Africa, and that informed the one of legislation for water in South Africa. So WWF approached me, and then I went and worked for WWF for about 4 years, where I started a program there around water stewardship. And they there really it was around how particularly one could harness private sector participation in managing water resources, because the private sector has significant footprint in terms of their impact on water, but they're also directly affected by they face significant risks in terms of exposure to water-related business risks. When I was running that program, I engaged with some of the biggest corporations like SABMiller now, which is B InBev, I think B InBev, it's a big conglomerate now. The Mondi Paper, a couple of other Nedbank and some other bank, commercial banks, so that are interested in conservation. So, but also, while I was running that program, that was the first time I kind of picked interest in the business side of conservation, why I think the private sector can play an important role in driving conservation. Because traditionally, conservation has been seen as an NGO-driven perspective,
Yes, that's right, yeah.
and mostly it's almost marginal, if you like, compared to your mainstream economic issues. But when you look at environmental risks as a business risk, you kind of turn the table in terms of the conversation that can be had. So one can engage with businesses using their language, so to speak, because they understand risk, they understand the kind of challenges they expose to their bottom line if, let's say, a company's premises are flooded, or if an insurance company has underwritten so many insurance policies, but because that location where these clients are is vulnerable to flooding, they will be exposed to all these claims that can be lodged against them. So that sparked me my interest, and then after working for WWF, that's when, well, all along I wanted to start up an entity that had a very specific Africa focus and had a very specific, if you like, bottom-up approach to doing conservation. Because my point of departure has always been that, like I told you in the start of my story, I've grown up in these communities, grown up closer to nature, and so on, and I wanted to work with organizations that drive that bottom-up approach that at least puts communities at the center of how conservation is done. Because traditional conservation has always been about, let's protect nature, let's fence off these landscapes, and therefore we'll protect our ecosystems. But we've learned that that's actually not feasible. People are part of the ecosystem, and so until you recognize that, it becomes very difficult to achieve the conservation outcomes that one would like to achieve.
If you go further back, conservation has a legacy of colonial interests, which considered wildlife over indigenous peoples and local communities. That was really, what I wanted to focus on in this podcast episode is, to what extent is that legacy still, elements of that legacy still remaining to some extent? I'm sure that it has changed I know that it has changed to a large extent. But I wanted to dig into how much does it still need to change, noting that conservation is most needed in developing countries and by developing countries, and yet most of the funding still comes from the developed world.
Yes. So we founded the African Center for Green Economy 8 years ago, and it was so. Our point of departure has always been that we want to set up a platform that is, Africa focused, that harnesses the capability of emerging African leaders, but also to place us at the forefront of how the continent's development agenda is set. Like I said, we come from these landscapes. We have got all the education that's required. We need to be in a position to be able to chart the way forward for the continent, because we have vested interests on this continent. And And the center was set up by pure coincidence. So when I was doing my PhD in the University of Cape Town, my co-founder, a colleague of mine who is from Zambia, who was also doing his PhD, I was in the Department of Zoology and he was in the Department of Geography and Environmental Sciences. We were on the same scholarship, okay? But they took us to a student conference in Beijing. And I met Dr. Sepo in Beijing. And then it's like, oh, hey, how? My name is Mao. My name is Sepo. Where are you from? And he said, you know, it's, oh, actually, it turned out we were on the same scholarship. We were studying related stuff, same university, but we hadn't known each other. And it took, you know, a scholarship in the US to bring us together. So for us, at that point, we said, you know, this should never have happened. We are just down the road. We need more connection between us, essentially, people who come from these communities and so on, because then we can self-organize to drive the, you know, environmental conservation agenda from our communities and so on. So from that time in Beijing, we set up in our mind we were going to set up this center that would be a platform that would amplify our voices, that would create opportunities to drive the continent's development agenda with very, very bottom-up type of approach. So that was the genesis of how the center was founded. And then I went and worked for all these organizations. And when the time was ripe, I decided that, you know, it's opportunity to set up the center. So we founded the center. And our positioning is that we like to act as an intermediary institution, basically bridging, if you like, these conversations that happen at a global, national level, or high-level policy discourse to the actors and doers on the ground. Because, I mean, this is almost across the world, you find the really innovative organizations that are doing amazing stuff on the ground and on a particular landscape, or in a particular community, or in a particular ecosystem. But obviously, because they are so focused on doing what they are good at, they kind of lose sometimes touch with where the conversation is at, and their voices never get heard there. In the same way, a lot of conversation happens at the global level, but does not find traction on the ground. Mm-hmm. And when you think about climate finance, for example, and how resources need to flow on the ground, oftentimes, you know, there's funding that is available, but there's lack of good projects that can be funded, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's climate finance and so on the ground. And that's because of that disconnect that exists. So people doing amazing stuff on the ground have no idea what funders are looking for mm-hmm. to be able to pitch their work in a way that speaks to these funders. And funders also can't
really find
the kind of good project they want on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an old age problem. We have spoken to impact investors in Switzerland, we've talked to you know, like big private equity funders and so on. There's that disconnect. So we've always positioned our institute as, how do we translate policy into practice? The idea of, you know, think, do, you know, we want to think, but also just want to be very practical in terms of what we do on the ground.
Your work is quite diverse, right? It's environment and development in general. How does conservation fit in with that? Is it integrated with other topics, or does it sort of form a silo by itself, you know, with specific staff who are dedicated to that topic?
Look, for me, our theory of change is that nature or building resilience is our core business. So in essence, a healthy environment is the base under which we do our work. And from there, all the other things emerge. So when we're looking at, for example, around working, let's say our work that we work with entrepreneurs, for example, green entrepreneurs, there we're trying to build business models that can be harnessed to empower communities, but also business models that are environmentally friendly, that do not result in polluting the environment. When we are working with communities, for example, building resilience or well-being at community level, we want to empower communities so that they to develop their adaptive capacity against climate change. So I would say that, and when we decide where we want to work, for example, it will be driven by whatever conservation priorities or conservation issues are on the ground. So if I look at the work that we do in South Africa, for example, with on the renewable energy belts. Obviously, there's the issue around transitioning into sustainable energy and providing energy access to vulnerable communities. But also, those are communities that have been significantly affected by drought because of the changing climate and changing landscape. So even though our work is not necessarily, let's say, protecting a specific ecosystem, let's say going on the ground doing a specific river rehabilitation or a forest, protecting a specific forest landscape, that is always the foundation under which we work. That, you know, these other secondary activities on the landscape that impact the integrity of the ecosystems is what we want to address, whether it's issues around systemic poverty or unlocking resources and innovations that allow communities to develop the adaptive capacity, obviously to, you know, to climate change and so on, are all kind of issues that we use to channel our efforts to ultimately protect the environment.
You were talking about conservation initiatives or environmental initiatives, the funders being disconnected from the people on the ground. You know, if there is funding available for something, and if the funder finds the organization, the grassroots organization, for example, is it not still a case that the funder will very much drive the agenda and how the initiative is implemented? And if so, do you think that that's something that needs to change, or is it more the case that funders are listening to grassroots organizations and adapting their design accordingly?
You know, Andre, I mean, I've find a mix of both. You find funders who have their own agendas in terms of what they want to achieve. You know, you might find a global organization that actually wants to build traction, okay, in a particular region or on a particular issue and so on. They will come with a prescription of what needs to be done on the ground. And we try, from our own experience, we try and stay far away from those types of programs as much as possible, or to try and influence it as much as possible. So in our approach, generally, we partner with anyone only if we are involved in the core design of the program. Because I think that's really important, that, you know, when you're designing a program, you need that kind of input, because I want to feel a sense of ownership of a particular project. But if someone comes in and, hey, we would like you to come and work with us on this particular project without you being part of how the process unfolded, it will be problematic. And having said that, I think that generally you find that at the end of the day, the person who signs the check has some influence in how work get done on the ground. But I think that for me, and our approach has always been that we have a strong offering. So if someone wants to work with us, it's not because we're just looking for money, but we come with good understanding of what is on the ground and being able to deliver all that kind of work. And increasingly, and that's why we won't, because a lot of these top-down approach has always been driven by also a perception that there's not enough expertise on the ground to help design a project that finds resonance with, whether it's local stakeholders or with local communities and so on. But increasingly, people are recognizing that that needs to change. And I think that it's turning around, but it's going to be a long time, Andre, that this happens. But my experience working with, let's say, some of these global, almost like development consulting outfits, I find more traction there, and to be honest with you, than some of the global NGOs. Because let's say DFID, for example, which is the UK development outfit, gives out a tender, you know, you'll find development consultancies would, let's say, pitch for that assignment, and they will want to find experts on the ground to help them deliver on the work. So you brought on board early enough. But there's a whole issue around, you know, how those kind of programs are run, because, you know, conservation is not, you know, it's business to some enterprise, some outfits. In trying to deliver that work, they need to find people on the ground to work with. Right. So we find that's almost an interesting partnership where someone is sitting in London, we partner with them, for them to deliver the project, you know, they need to partner with us on the ground, and we can influence how that happens. Mm-hmm. It's different from an NGO coming, let's say, and say, okay, here is this amount of funding, we want you to do X, Y, Z. So it's those types of partnerships. I think that there are different ways of working on the ground. That, and having said that, you know, there's nothing wrong with donors donating funding on the ground, but I think that they need to build expertise is very, very, very critical. And a lot of times that doesn't happen.
Right. So the expertise comes from outside, and perhaps the components of the work that don't require any expertise might bring in local people, but then not very much is learned and not much stays on the ground after the project's finished, right?
Yes, yes. And the thing is, and then once the project is finished, these issues around sustainability, you know, you have to look for the next thing, you know, and then just becomes a cycle. I remember a few years ago in Kenya, in one of, for the Lake Victoria Basin, and I'm not going to name, but one international development agency mm-hmm. told us, like, you know, in this landscape, this mountain landscape, they have been working there since 1983 on issues around community conservation and on addressing erosion, and so millions of dollars have been invested in that landscape. But more than 30 years later, the same problem still persists. And that for me speaks probably to one of the biggest career change in perspective that I've had around how we use market-based mechanisms in a much more innovative way to bring about change on the ground, particularly at the community level, and how we use approaches like working with the small businesses, for example, mm-hmm. Working with entrepreneurs and so on, because people who run local business in a particular community have a vested interest. And so if you invest in a local business, it's likely that it will be sustainable moving forward. Mm-hmm. And also working with those type of market mechanisms prevents the idea of, how do I say, of handouts. Mm-hmm. Because handouts ultimately, you know, go against, you know, building a sustainable community.
Right. They have a very limited lifespan, don't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But if you support local entrepreneurs who are going to build a business that is also going to feed or meet a specific demand, then you have, you're likely to achieve a much more sustainable outcome, as opposed to someone say, oh, we've got this amount of funding. What do you think we should do in this community?
I was actually just about to ask you in fact, I had two questions, but let me ask this one first. So you mentioned local businesses now. I was going to ask you who is involved in this sort of landscape. We've spoken about donors, and we've spoken very generally about people on the ground. But who are the people on the ground? So you, for example, are running what I would, from that, as an outsider, I would view as a regional organization, because you're based in South Africa, but you work across Southern and East Africa. And you're an NGO, right? So who are the other players involved, apart from the international donors, who, you know, which is where most of the funding comes from?
One of the programs that we work on is basically we have landscape leaders. So, and we want to talk about landscape leaders, we're talking about, let's say, community-based organizations that are found, that are within those communities, one tier of potential actors. They tend to be NGOs. We have networks of, let's say, small enterprise associations that are also within a particular locations. You have individual businesses that are located at the landscape level. Sometimes NGOs that are, where there's big NGOs, but have got a presence in a particular landscape, they might also be part of this process. For example, there's a work program that we work indirectly with called the African Landscapes Dialogue. So this is convened by a group in the US called Eco Agriculture Partners, and we've been partnering with them for a couple of years now. And that idea, that the African Landscape Dialogue convenes annually in Ethiopia, sometimes in Kenya, and the last one we just had last in November in Tanzania. And what it does is it looks at all different landscapes, both in East and Southern Africa, and says, how can we support these, what I call landscape leaders who are on the ground? These are conservation practitioners who are working on all sorts of issues, whether it's, you know, payment for ecosystem services, protecting watersheds, implementing climate smart agriculture, you know, practices, and so on. And once a year, we convene this dialogue that brings all these landscape practitioners and go through a process of peer-to-peer learning, sharing any types of tools that are available, and so on. And then they can go back and experiment with these ideas on their landscape and come and share these learnings in the next dialogue, so to speak. So there's a mix of actors on the ground.
So you're talking about building capacity as the work is being done, right? Which also goes back to what we were saying about sustainability of projects.
I think that, you know, capacity building is, I mean, skills transfer, it's absolutely critical. But also not just your traditional skills transfer, even just creating space for peer-to-peer learning, because people learn best by emulating others, you know. They've done that they've perfected this kind of methodology quite well, particularly in the agricultural space, where in countries like Mozambique, Zambia, they've got a program called Lead Farmers Program. So farmers that are really implementing cutting edge innovations that have been able to build sustainable agricultural enterprises and so on, become anchors to other farmers to learn from, to adopt those kind of measures and so on. So you as an outsider, kind of your only role is to just broker those relationships, but the learning should just be horizontal as opposed to, you know, a top-down type of approach.
Right. And then for conservation in particular, I can imagine, because agriculture is the center of the livelihoods of most of the communities that you're talking about, at least the rural communities. When thinking about conservation more specifically, you know, when, for example, if a donor wants to do something about conserving species, you know, talking about the conservation at its most basic, I suppose, in that sense, in capacity building in a situation like that, do you find that there is a local willingness to participate and to learn those kinds of skills?
Look, I think that my experience, and this is mostly from East Africa, is that when you come with any intervention, that is, let's say, a conservation intervention, it has to be embedded in the local realities of the community. So you can't just do conservation for the sake of conservation,
right?
Because ultimately the local communities have their own priorities. We have experience, for example, in East Africa with the shea butter and the shea trees, the native to the East African region. It has potentially significant economic benefit in terms of the shea butter that can be harvested, leave alone that, you know, it's the shea tree forest is very good for, let's say, bee or conservation and therefore pollination services and so on. But in these communities, the most immediate economic value they get out of the shea tree is cutting it down for charcoal. So they're cutting these mature trees to burn it for charcoal, because that's the most immediate realization that needs to happen. So in this context, if you want to come and do anything about the shea tree conservation, you're not going to tell communities, essentially preach them, oh, the shea tree is very important and so on. You have to provide alternative income generating activities. You need to demonstrate that actually, if you do beekeeping, you can get more money out of honey than by selling charcoal. You know, so it's that kind of embedding conservation education and capacity building in the local reality, because ultimately what you need is that you need communities to be able to own these issues, and for them to be able to own it, has to be very well embedded in their own realities.
I can imagine also cases in which a conservation organization might, you know, their motivation might be to conserve, Whereas, of course, people in the local community's priority is to, live a good life. So it's a, I guess it's often a case of the compatibility between those two aims. But what will determine the long-term success of a project is always going to be what local people need, which is not necessarily, or in the past has not necessarily been compatible with what conservation organizations want. And I guess that that is the transition which is still being made, and which some organizations are making and other organizations perhaps not.
You know, what we never talk about a lot in conservation, which is actually a reality sometimes, is the trade-offs that could potentially exist.
Yes.
And some time back, we did work for, I think it was WWF UK, no, the New Economics Foundation, looking at the trade-offs between the different SDGs. And in Kenya, in that, you know, sometimes you might be driving towards, they say, achieving the SDG for renewable energy, for example, that could be negatively impacting another SDG. You know,
Right.
so those trade-offs that we're talking about, like we're talking about community empowerment, access to key resources, and so on. But in the process of achieving those goals, you might also be infringing on other potential, outcomes that could, negate what you're trying to seek. So I think the idea of core benefits and finding solutions that create win-win situations. I think that there's not enough conversation happening around this, because those are the kind of measures that we need to capitalize on to say this is actually what works for multiple outcomes, and pump our resources in those types of intervention, as
Right.
opposed to silo type interventions that are in the long run actually do not serve the purpose.
And do you think that enough is being done to identify which are the ones which we should be prioritizing and putting resources into?
Not actually, because at the moment we're doing some work for UNEP on ecosystem-based adaptation. And we're trying to look at what are the different types of ecosystem-based adaptation measures or projects that have been implemented across the world that have this core benefit approach. And it's very, very seldom do you get a comprehensive idea of what is actually happening. So there's not much. And it's because of the, it's also quite fuzzy, because a lot of these interventions, you can't really demarcate them as achieving a specific outcome and so on. But I think that innovation really happens in those spaces of uncertainties. But the problem obviously, goes back to the issue around funders. Funders are looking for specific outcomes that are measurable. They'll tell you, like, you're applying for funding, it has to be measurable, it has to be very independently verified and so on. But a lot of the things that need to happen on the ground oftentimes are in that, gray area. And gray area is where actual real innovation happens, and where you start to push the boundary on some of these issues.
I wanted to ask about tourism in particular, very much along the lines of what we've been discussing now. We spoke about the need for sustainability of initiatives. And I think tourism is probably the most guilty culprit of all in terms of things having been done the wrong way in the past. What is your perception of the way that conservation tourism is working these days? And do you think that that is, in your experience, in the areas that you're familiar with, especially Southern and East Africa, do you think that it's being done the right way now, or do you think that there's a lot of room for improvement there in that particular sector?
Look, I mean, there's so much that needs to be done in conservation. I mean, for me, what the freshest image in my mind at the moment is 2 weeks ago during the wildebeest migration in the Maasai Mara in Kenya and Tanzania. The traffic jam in the wilderness, I mean, the number of off-road vehicles that are packed, it's like you're having a traffic jam in a national park, Andre. I think that obviously conservation needs funding, and we need, I mean, I digress. I would argue, and I've never really done these statistics, that a lot of the funding that is actually generated from tourism is not really going to doing the conservation. It's basically going into national fiscals of countries and going to do other things. Because otherwise we would not be struggling in the conservation sector saying there's not enough funding, there's not enough funding, there's not enough funding, there's not enough going through to conservation. And tourism is not being done in a way that is sustainable. These pockets of ecotourism ventures here and there, but still, to a large extent, is window dressing. I think there's a lot that can be done in the tourism sector. And an obvious thing, for example, for me, I would argue is how do we promote more domestic tourism, for example? And we've seen with the COVID, where countries like South Africa's tourism industry has been completely decimated. Because we're expecting tourists to fly from overseas, and that has dried out, and the local tourism sector is not mature enough to kind of close that gap. So I think there is disruption that needs to happen in the tourism sector. But increasingly, we're starting to see the categories, certain tourists, the more discerning tourists who are looking for the unique experience, that the untrodden path, who are not necessarily looking for the big, if you like, pathways that the traditional tourism has always walked. So there's a lot that needs to happen.
So I guess that might be a topic for another podcast entirely. It's quite a big topic.
Exactly. No, well, I think we've covered quite a broad range of issues. I just want to say, it's such a pleasure chatting to you. And for me, I think probably my last word is going to be conservation really is where the future of this planet is. And we should never tire from, ensuring that we protect our critical ecosystems, because that's what our children and our children's children will have, so it's absolutely, critical that we do what is needed in the face of all this uncertainty that there is.
Well, I guess that discussion indicates what a big topic this is. I think that we might need to address it again in another episode sometime. Meanwhile, I'm grateful to Mao for those thought-provoking views. You can find links to information about Mao's organization, FreeCGE, and other things discussed in the interview in the show notes for this episode. And there you'll also find a link to the podcast put out by FreeCGE called Green Insights. And Mao will actually be posting this discussion that we just had on that platform as well. And there are several other episodes to choose from there. Next time, I'll be speaking with Nick Askew. Nick is founding director of Conservation Careers, statistically speaking, the world's leading advice center on conservation as a career path. I wanted his take on why anyone would or should want to dedicate their career to a task as formidable as sustaining the diversity of life on Earth, especially considering that conservation is not known for its money-making potential as a career. I'll also be asking him how we can encourage greater ethnic diversity among conservationists. Please join us if you or someone you know is considering starting or switching to a career in conservation, or just to listen in and enjoy the conversation.